And welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today. We're going to start off with a song from 1951. And this is Charles Trenet, who was a French singer from France. I guess was very kind of cabaret style and perhaps a contemporary of somebody like Edith Piaf. But this is the song Voyage au Canada.
Une famille des plus charmantes, trois enfants, maman, papa, partit en beau jour de Nantes pour visiter le Canada. Fixant leur itinéraire, après maintes réflexions, ils choisirent pas ordinaire ces moyens de locomotion. C'est ainsi qu'avant de partir, ils chantaient pour se divertir. Nous irons à Toronto en auto. Nous irons à Montréal à cheval. Nous traverserons Québec à pied sec. Nous irons à Ottawa en wawa. Nous irons à Valleyfield sur un fil. Nous irons à Trois-Rivières en litière. Passant par Chicoutimi endormi. Nous irons au lac Saint-Jean en nageant. Voilà, voilà. Un beau voyage, voilà, voilà, un beau voyage au Canada. Oui, mais parfois c'est étrange, on ne fait pas toujours ce qu'on veut. Bien souvent le hasard change nos projets les plus heureux. Nos amis furent, c'est pas de chance, victimes d'une distraction du chef du bureau de l'agence, des moyens de locomotion, et à cause d'un employé qui s'était trompé de billet. Ils allèrent à Toronto en nageant. Ils allèrent à Montréal endormis. Ils se rendirent à Québec en litière. Ils allèrent à Ottawa sur un fil. Ils allèrent à Valleyfield à pied sec. Ils allèrent à Trois-Rivières en wawa. Passant par Chicoutimi un cheval. Ils plongèrent dans le lac Saint-Jean en auto. Voilà, voilà. Un beau voyage, voilà, voilà, un beau voyage au Canada.
Depuis ce temps-là, messieurs, dames, les voyageurs ont compris, pour éviter bien des drames, il faut à n'importe quel prix contrôler dans les agences les billets de locomotion. Si vous partez en vacances, la plus simple des précautions, c'est de chanter mon petit air itinéraire. Une, deux, nous irons à Toronto en auto.
En auto.
Nous irons à Montréal à cheval.
À cheval.
Nous traverserons Québec à pied sec.
À pied sec.
Nous irons à Ottawa en wawa.
En wawa.
Nous irons à Valleyfield sur un fil.
Sur un fil.
Nous irons à Trois-Rivières en litière.
En litière.
Passant par Chicoutimi en dormant.
Endormi,
nous irons au lac Saint-Jean en nageant,
en nageant.
Voilà, voilà, un beau voyage, un beau voyage. Voilà, voilà, un beau voyage au Canada.
And that was Voyage au Canada by Charles Trenet from 1951. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today. A little bit of a sad show for me. I chose to feature two talks, which I found on the internet by Wayne Roberts. Wayne Roberts, who was a very influential person when it came to food security and good healthy food in Canada, especially Toronto. And Wayne Roberts was the author of The No-Nonsense Guide to World Food and a number of other books, which I'll tell you about. But I actually took a course with him at York University when I was doing my master's in environmental studies. And I can't remember exactly the title of the course, but I know it related to media somehow. And it was co-taught with his wife, Lori Stallbrand, who had been a CBC reporter, but both of them, I think, by then were working on food issues. And Wayne Roberts really was just anyone who met Wayne Roberts was, touched by his generosity, by his sense of humor, He was the type of guy who laughed a lot, you know, liked to laugh at his own jokes or his own puns. And, you know, he was always just a joy to be around. And, you know, he gave me some of the best advice when I was taking that course with him at York University. I was actually working on a film about the farmer Ken Taylor, who was also a chemistry professor at John Abbott College at the time. And it was a film that is now distributed by the National Film Board of Canada, and it's called Organic Prophecies. But when I was working on that film, and it was still kind of in the beginning stages, or the sort of middle stages before I finished it, and I actually finished it while I was finishing my master's degree at York University in Environmental Studies. But he gave me some of the best advice that really helped me orient myself, orient the film, or orient myself in terms of how I was approaching the film, and I'll never forget that. And then years later, I would see him at various events in Toronto or other spots in Ontario. I remember I was a regular traveler to the Guelph Organic Conference, which happened at Guelph University every year in Guelph, Ontario. Always actually around this time. It was a conference that happened in January. And it was a fabulous conference, you know, especially if you're a foodie like me and you love eating organic food and healthy food. You know, you'd go to this conference, especially at a time when that was less mainstream, and there would be so many things to sample and eat, and so many books and so many farmers with great wisdom around. And you know, it was just a fabulous event. I had so many great experiences there. And one of the times, Wayne Roberts was a featured speaker. And I remember his talk being one of the best talks I ever saw at the Guelph Organic Conference. And, you know, again, he just, you know, emanated this great energy in the room. And, you know, it's very sad that he has passed away. So he passed away January 20th. He had leukemia. I was not aware that he was sick. But when I saw that on Facebook, his wife, Lori Stahlbrand, put something up, I was really quite saddened, and I shed a few tears. So today we are going to feature a couple of talks by Wayne Roberts, and that's to pay tribute to this great guy who, like I said, especially in activist circles in Toronto, everybody knows Wayne Roberts. So he was an activist, he was a food policy analyst, he was a writer, he had a PhD in social and economic history from University of Toronto, which he received in 1978. My understanding also is he went to Berkeley during that, you know, key hippie period in the 60s. He authored 7 books, but the ones that kind of stand out for me are Get a Life, Real Food for a Change, and The No-Nonsense Guide to World Food. And he often wrote about the intersection of environmental, food, and social issues. He won a number of awards, including the University of Toronto Arbor Award in recognition of his development of a food security course in the Equity Studies program at New College, and his role in creating the Global Food Equity Stream Initiative. It was under his leadership that the Toronto Food Policy Council developed Toronto's Food Charter, and for that he received the Bob Hunter Environmental Achievement Award in 2009. He also chaired the Coalition for a Green Economy for 15 years and served on the boards of the Community Food Security Coalition and Food Secure Canada. Before that, he had an extensive career in community organizing, labor education, and union administration, and he wrote several books on unions, including Cracking the Canadian Formula and Don't Call Me Servant, which was published in 1993. He is survived by his wife and collaborator, Dr. Lori Stahlbrand, and his children, Annika Roberts Stahlbrand and Jamie Kirzner Roberts. So the first talk we're going to play comes from a presentation he gave to a course at Johns Hopkins University. It was a course called An Introduction to the U.S. Food System, Perspectives from Public Health. So he was brought in to give a presentation about his work with the Toronto Food Policy Council. So here is that talk now.
Wayne Roberts is a leading Canadian thinker and writer on food and sustainability issues. In 2001, Now magazine named him one of Toronto's top 10 visionaries of the past 20 years. Wayne served as the Dodge Lecturer for the Center for Livable Future several years ago and remains a close friend and collaborator.
Thanks, Bob. And I'm going to tell you about some of my exploits as a manager for Toronto Public Health. And my job is to work with the Toronto Food Policy Council, which is 30 very active citizens, all of whom have been picked by the Board of Health. And their job is to help the city implement the Toronto Food Charter, which I'll be talking about. And my job is to take their truth to power. So that's where I fit in. And I'd like to talk to you about four of the aspects of the work that I do. And I think the exciting thing about the food movement is that it's tied into themes which are much bigger than food. And I think that's what invests so much excitement and importance to it. And one of them is that I believe it's part of the fastest growing institutional change in government today, that is the creation of food policy councils. And they're now starting to take place across many states in the U.S., many cities, and they're starting to take place in hospitals. It's a Swiss Army knife of food change that has so many tools and so many uses. The second is that it is, I believe, the fastest growing sector of the new economy, which is centered around what are called social enterprises, that is, businesses that are half business and half social agencies. And the third reason why I think it's so exciting is that Americans call the nonprofit sector what Canadians and Europeans call the non-government organizations. It is, food is the fastest growing sector. It's the explosive element within that sector. And I believe it's helping to give it a cast of a new people's movement, that what democracy and democratic governments did in America in the 1790s and in other parts of the world throughout the 1800s, now these citizens' organizations are doing today, and food is right out front there. And the last is, I think it's the biggest expansion we've seen in terms of understanding of the sources of health, that food is going way beyond what's sometimes called the medical model, and way beyond even the public health, traditional public health model, into a whole new set of considerations about what is the basis of good health. So that's what I'm going to try to talk about. And weirdly enough, the environment is sort of woven all through that, just like food. So I hope you'll see that food, environment, and those four themes coming out. Well, Toronto's modern food system begins in the 1980s. When we had the first food banks came to the city. And it was a very traumatic experience for everyone in the city, not just the poor people who went there, but for the well-to-do and the elite. They never thought that this was a city that would have that kind of poverty. And the most conservative elements within the city said, we are not prepared to have a city where that is true. And so in 1986, the city put money to form a non-government organization called FoodShare, which has since become the largest city-based food security organization in North America, to say, find alternatives to food banks. We're not going to allow people in this city to depend on charity to eat. And so that's when people started to say, okay, what are some different ways to do things than we've traditionally done, because those ways aren't working. And 5 years later, the food share had not eliminated the problems that led to food banks. And so the city council created the Toronto Food Policy Council. It captures what we're about, which is that we start with a sense of tremendous abundance and bounty in the world. We do not live in a world of scarcity, but in a world of plenty. And the problems of food have to do with not being able to manage abundance, that we have insufficient amount of food. And so that's sort of what's behind us. And just as a side point, you get the sense of the assets that a city can bring. In 1998, the city was amalgamated by an order from the higher level of government, which is something that Americans don't know about because cities are quite a bit more independent constitutionally in the United States. And so Toronto used to be described as a New York run by the Swiss. And after amalgamation, it had been sometimes described as Vienna surrounded by Phoenix or swallowed by Phoenix. And there were fears that there were just this enormous cultural clash that wouldn't work. But in fact, it's worked, I believe, reasonably well. It's worked very well for the Food Policy Council because we've really doubled our influence in a very short period of time. And to commemorate the new city, one of the things that was done is that we developed a food charter. And you can Google that and get the whole thing. It's quite short but sweet. And basically, it came out of a really important device, which I hope will spread somewhere. And that is that we proceeded on the basis of backcasting. And Americans need to learn how to do this because everyone is so fearful of the future. You have a lot of arguments. And what we did is to say, where do we want Toronto to be in 2020? What's the kind of city we want? Do we want children to go to school hungry? Do we want seniors to be without food or not be able to get to a store? Like, what is the future? Where do we want to be? And then where do we start today to get there? That's called backcasting. It's a very powerful technique for developing consensus, because who is going to say, you know what, I think it's good for the character of children to grow up hungry? And so it was a very powerful technique. And this, as almost everything that the Food Policy Council has brought forward, although it may seem controversial from outside, I've never taken a position to this city that did not have unanimous support except one once. And that I lived to rue the day that I did that. So we've always had enormous consensus to the point of unanimity in most cases. But what this does is two things. And one is it says the city is in the food business. This is not just for state governments and federal governments. This is for cities. And it's not just about agriculture and people who produce it. It's about people who eat it and how it shapes their lives. And then secondly, it's not just about being customers. It's about rights. It's about the rights of people to have food and have it in certain circumstances. So basically, that's the document that guides us. It's our job. The city does not live up to this charter now, and perhaps may never, but it's our job to help the city move towards it. And so that's what gives us our mandate. And this isn't often understood, because we take food so for granted that we forget exactly what a 900-pound gorilla or a several-ton elephant it is. It is the biggest source of non-point source pollution in the world. It is the biggest land use in the world. It is the largest occupational group in the world. It is the biggest cause of poverty in the world. It is the number one employer of child labor in the world. You name it, it is number one. And how can it be otherwise? 6.7 billion people in the world eating an average of 3 meals a day, because for everyone who eats one, there's somebody else eating the equivalent of 4 and 5. Any issue you want to name, you got to multiply it by 18 billion plus. A day, it's going to have a huge impact. And within that framework, it's going to have a big environmental impact, and it's going to have a big economic impact. And so we have not yet really come to grips as a society, weird as it may sound, with the enormity of food. So believe it or not, in Toronto, as I would dare say in most parts of the United States, food has not been understood as an environmental issue until quite recently. It's been seen as a poverty issue for food banks or a health issue, but it's never been seen as an environmental issue. And so that's part of the work that we have done, I hope, is to shape the thinking of people in Toronto and hopefully elsewhere about why you need to take food seriously, even if you're not interested in food. That's our motto. That food is a big issue and it's a city issue. And the second element is that it's a public policy issue. It's not just about shopping, and not just about shopping in a good way, which a lot of critics who say, well, what can you do? Then they're all, you can shop for this and you can shop for that. And I'm totally in favor of shopping as properly as we can, but environmentalism is not about a new way of shopping. So one example of that I'd like to just bring to your attention is the whole issue of breastfeeding, which is surrounded by issues of rights. Like, for instance, there is the right of a woman to be in public and to breastfeed her baby in public without any fear of being considered vulgar or rude or anything like that. And the Toronto Food Policy Council in the 1990s played a really important role in pushing that through the Human Rights Code, that this would be protected, the right of women to breastfeed in public places. And Toronto, the City of Toronto, has been an incredible champion of that. And another aspect of it is, if you want to encourage breastfeeding, to be honest, you need to have maternity leave, which in Canada is for a year. You're covered by the government while you're away, and usually by the employer to top it up. So in other words, we need to understand that food is a public policy issue. It is not just a consumer issue. And so there's lots of consequences to this. Now, in the City of Toronto, for instance, just to give an example, we have new baby clinics. They reach out to all women who have just had a baby and say, do you need some help on this? On how to bathe your baby, what to do if they cough and don't stop, and as Benjamin Swack said, what do you do the first time they fall on their head, and all these kinds of things, and how to breastfeed. And the incredible thing about these is, A, they form incredible neighborhoods, which I'll talk to you about in a minute, but I believe this is where social capital begins. This is why food is a public policy issue. As you see from this young child, is that it's not just about nutrition, it's about bonding. And it's about bonding between the mom and the new baby. And it's also partially about, as you see here, bonding between the other siblings. It's where we learn to communicate through food. And then later, food brings us in touch with our whole neighborhood. That's why it's so important to identify it as a public policy issue that belongs in government. If you know the old saying that you meet a nice boss, they say, anytime you got a problem, my door is always open. Well, we say, anytime you got a solution, my door is always open. The Food Policy Council is not in business to talk about problems. It is only in business to talk about solutions. And that's one aspect of it. And the other aspect of it is that we are not there to say, well, you're for the supermarkets and you're for the food banks and you're for this. We're there to help the city implement the Toronto Food Charter. And we bring a particular expertise which will help them do it. And the point about Food Policy Council in Toronto, which I think other cities would be wise to imitate, is that you need a staff position. It can't just be volunteers. Somebody's got to do the heavy lifting, making sure you got rooms, you got coffee, and that is trusted by other staff people who work for the city who have access. And the fifth is that we treat food policy like a Rubik's Cube. You cannot solve a Rubik's Cube by just trying to get all white on one side. You've got to be thinking about six sides of the Rubik's Cube. That's why people find it so tough to get to. And in the food area, as in most areas of life, we make a mistake by trying to solve one side of the problem. So you've got a weight issue and you're going to try to go off carbs or go on the watermelon diet or whatever crackpot scheme that is there. And the reason why they're crackpot and they don't work is that the issue is not slimming down. The issue is getting healthy. And so what a Food Policy Council tries to do is to have a Rubik's Cube view. In other words, we look at the food as a system, not as a series of isolated problems. And the sixth element of Food Policy Council is that it has active engagement with citizen groups. There's a couple of elements to that. And one is we're not a standoffish group, which you might think we are when you hear the word policy, as in wonk. We are a roll-up-your-sleeves organization. That's the style we generate ourselves and that we encourage in the whole movement, is we're not here to talk ideas and criticisms. We're here to get the work done. And another aspect is that we're engaged in what is sometimes called action learning, that we are learning. It's not the citizens are not a pressure group that are bugging us to do something. The citizens are a group of people who have an experience that we need to learn from to make good policy. And that's what the community engagement is about. And I think we're counter to that view that started to, the language that started to develop in the 1980s and 90s about vested interest groups of, you know, neighborhood groups and Greenpeacers and all the like. No, these are all just part of an active citizenry, and we're trying to crystallize what are the lessons that they can take. And one of our jobs, too, is to raise the capacity of non-government or non-profits, which often are developing with a very minimum of budget and a minimum of skills and things they didn't think they needed to know, like personnel management and the like, and say, well, how can we use all our resources so that we can work more effectively together? Now, the University of Toronto is just about to launch a major experience in what they call service learning, so where you actually take a course every semester where your job is to work in an agency and you learn by being on the job, as it were. And so a lot of that's going to happen in food organizations. And that came out of this meeting that we held 4 years ago. So we're trying to raise the capacity, not only of government, but of others. And the seventh element, the last one, is we travel light, which is another way of saying we have a minuscule budget. And it's a small staff. Most of my 10 years there have been as a sole employee with a support staff who does the work of about five people. And the last year I've had a second colleague. And the reason why we're able to travel light, I think we shouldn't be as light as we are, but we don't need to be a lot heavier, is that that forces us to partner with other groups. And here's an example. There's a university about 75 miles away, which has an excellent environmental studies program. They put out a magazine called Alternatives, have partnered with them for two issues on food, and I'm on the editorial board, and there's always a food presence in it. So they can pay for the publication, they can handle the editing, but, you know, we're bringing the ideas. And so I think a good Food Policy Council is one that can travel light.
And that was a talk by Wayne Roberts, which he gave to a course at Johns Hopkins University, a course about the U.S. food system, and he was bringing his perspective from his work on the Toronto Food Policy Council. So the second talk that we're going to play now is from more recently in 2017, when Wayne Roberts was invited to speak at an event put on by the University of Michigan Sustainable Food Systems Initiative And I believe the event was called Food Literacy for All. And Wayne Roberts spoke there on April 4th, 2017. And he was, again, a sort of, you know, he's speaking to an American audience, but talking about his experience in Canada and, you know, many of the life lessons he learned being a food activist. So here is that talk now.
When I talk about making America's cities great again, I mean, we're looking forward to a world that is now 50% urban and will soon be 60% urban and fairly soon be 70% urban. So we're talking about looking forward, not looking backward. And we're talking about cities that have got a lot of grit, like this scene here, a big crowd like this scene here, but also have lots of room for individuals to follow their own dreams. It will make a lot of people feel like they really belong. And that, in my opinion, is the essence of what a great city is. And I want to talk about why food is central to that concept. Now, my inspiration for this talk did not come from La La Land, but from pretty well the opposite, which is Catherine Lennon here in Edmonton, Alberta, which has many differences with La La Land. One is it's 20 below in Canadian temperature or 13 below in American temperature, which is it's cold. The days are short and dark all through the winter. And this is the kind of a typical Edmonton personality. So she picked me up at 6:30 in the morning for a coffee for an all-day meeting with their planners. And we walked into this independent coffee and chocolate shop. And a woman there just beamed a big smile at me. And we started yakking away. And then as we left, I said, "Well, where do you know her from?" She said, "I don't know her." She's just from Edmonton. That's the way people are. And that was my introduction to social capital, which I believe is the key to what food has to offer a city. I want to say I'll be making a few more references to Canada than you're perhaps used to, although I will mention at some point that marijuana will soon be legal in Canada. I have mainly learned from the United States. I was involved in the People's Park movement in Berkeley when I was a graduate student there in the 60s, which was really the first case of modern urban agriculture. I was a member of the Community Food Security Coalition board for many years in the US. It's where I met Malik and many other people and really learned the concept of food security from here. And the concept of food policy councils actually developed in the United States, mainly in cities that were very hard hit by the recessions of the 1980s. So that's an import into Canada. So although I'll be giving you some Canadian pictures and examples, my information is very much inspired by and based on what's happened here. So I want to talk about what I consider to be seven key principles that we've tried to follow that I think lead to healing. And the first is an understanding of food as an actionist issue. This is Michael Sacco climbing up a mountain in Oaxaca, Mexico, with cacao in his back. And I met him at a food conference about 15 years ago. And I'm standing behind our Toronto Food Policy Council table with the usual sort of one person every once in a while that I would corral into coming to talk to me. And I see down the aisle from me is this guy has lineups, 40 long, waiting to get to his table. And I find out, well, the reason why is that they make cacao, which comes from Mexico, into chocolate. They are a bean-to-bar organization. And they start off by bicycling, using bicycle power to turn the cacao and to crack it. And so that they reduce the amount of fossil fuel energy that they have to use to make the product. And so he was charging people to come in and use the bicycle. I thought, that is in the best tradition of Tom Sawyer, right? And so I thought, whatever he's doing, I want to do. And he taught me the term actionism, which is, in a sense, a distinction from activism. Activism, you could say, is I am going to a demonstration to say someone else should do something about the problem. And actionism is, I am taking my power to do something about it. And I believe food intrinsically lends itself to actionism, because you can't eat without shopping or without making a choice of what you're going to buy or without cooking or without, at the very least, putting the food from the plate to your mouth. You can't just turn on a switch. You have to be engaged in it in some way. And I believe actionism honors that human reality of food. And it speaks to the first principle, that food is empowering. Whether it is that you're shopping and deliberately buying fair trade or local or and sustainable or organic, or you're eating to reduce your meat or whatever it is you're doing, you are taking power. And that's something that food offers that public transit does not necessarily offer, or that other issues, it's something unique to food. Second, it gives the opportunity for people who are active in the field not to lead by telling people what to do, but to lead by example, which, as we know, that's how children learn and that's how adults learn as well. Thirdly, that instead of demonstration protests, which many people feel negative about or they don't want to participate in, it allows us to appeal to a more positive thing, which is a demonstration project. Fourth, it's a little a switch on the Gandhi phrase, which many of you have been influenced and inspired by, including me. But he said, be the change you want to see. And actionism is, create the change you want to see. And finally, platforms. I think if you think of the most powerful, or among the most powerful corporations in the world today, or the biggest at any rate, most influential in terms of public opinion, you'd have to put Facebook and Google somewhere near the top. They don't come at you with a particular program or a particular product. They come at you with a platform that allows you to choose. And I think what actionism invites us to do is to create food not as a program that if you agree with this, you come in, but an area of interest if you agree with this, come in, and we'll build a big tent and work to achieve it, and we'll work out our differences as we go through. So those are the concepts that I think are involved in which I have tried to inculcate in the Toronto food scene. Second is, I believe we have a tradition of being solutionaries. And this is a very famous Canadian, Jack Layton. As you can see from this photo, he's sort of Bernie Sanders on steroids. And he was an angry young man, like many of us. And then somebody asked him, his name is Jack Layton, he said, met him at a party and said, is your name Butt Jack? He says, what do you mean, is my name Butt Jack? He said, well, because anytime I read something, he was a leading city councilor in the city of Toronto. He said, anytime I read about, they say, Mayor so-and-so or Councilor so-and-so says, this is what we should do about the homeless. But Jack Layton says so-and-so. And every time he read a story, it always said, but Jack Layton. So he recognized that he was known only for the things he opposed and not any of the things that he proposed. So he developed the slogan, from opposition to proposition. That was always his calling card. I'm not coming at you at any time with a problem. I'm coming at you with a solution. That's how we can talk about whether it's the right one or not, but I'm not here to complain. And he really grabbed onto food as it became a movement, and one of his sayings was that food is an opportunity, not a problem. And the point about a solutionary, so he literally changed his personality to move from being an opponent to a proponent, is to be constructive, to pick projects that are doable, and finally is to always pick projects that are good on many, right across the spectrum. It's good for individual health, it's good for the environment, it's good for community development, it's good for the economy. Win, win, win. Unfortunately, he developed prostate cancer fairly early in his life, and when he was ahead of the National Opposition Party in Canada, died, and in his last years became known for his constructive personality. So that's the poster that was put out at the time of his death. And although he was on what you would call the Bernie Sanders part of the spectrum, there was actually 3 days of official mourning in the country and a state funeral for him when he died. So that's the power, in my opinion, of the solutionary position. Third is what some politicians in Canada call deliverology. If you want to be effective, you need to be thinking of not of problems but solutions, and not just of solutions but solutions that governments or corporations or schools or universities can do. And that's what deliverology is, thinking like a deliverologist. And if you look at the range of problems that are in the world, of which we have a true abundance, many of them fall under the category of being a low-hanging fruit. They don't require this person to go right up to the top of the apple tree. There's a whole bunch right down there. So why don't we start with the ones that are an arm's reach away? So that's what low-hanging fruit is. One of the definitions of low-hanging fruit is that it has a champion in government, like a city councilor, for example, or a mayor, or a champion within the civil service, because politicians can vote all sorts of things and nothing happens to them, and a champion within the community. So you need champions at three levels. You need to put forward something that administratively is capable, that there's a department that does it, that there's people in charge of it, they have a budget. You need to make a business case for it or an economic case for it. It has to make sense, because every government is saying we'd like to do it, but we don't have the money, we can't afford it. And then our argument always is, no, you can't afford not to do it. That you've got a community base that will help in the delivery of it, and that there is a separation of the personal and political, which is a whole other kettle of fish, but maybe if we want to, we can get into it in the question period. So that's the third principle. The fourth is to promote social capital. Some people find the term a little offensive because it's talking about community cohesion and social support as if it's a form of capital. But that's the term that it's come to be used by, so I'm not going to concoct a new term. But there's two forms of social capital, and one is called bonding, and the next one is called bridging. Bonding social capital is, you know, we often hear that the food movement is a yuppie kind of movement. Here's a group of yuppies in Toronto who were in charge of the first community garden in the early 1980s. It's in Regent Park, which is the largest social housing project in North America. And they're all Chinese seniors. And so they want a place where they belong. Everyone speaks their language, understands what their life has been about. And the garden is a very logical, apart from the fact that many of them were raised either as peasants or as gardeners. And if you come into the Chinese area in Toronto, you'll see it's full of gardens. So it's a hobby they very much like. But it's mainly that they want to spend time together, and they feel they're mostly in a society where they're a bit estranged in terms of language and customs. And here's a place to just be, like you like comfort food sometimes when you're stressed. They want to be in a place where they're with their own kind, their own tribe in a sense. And a term that's been developed by a Welsh scholar, Kevin Morgan, is the convening power of food, that food and gardening and those activities draw people together, closely together. Think of the family meal or Thanksgiving dinner, something like that. And the point about bonding capital is that it fosters personal, family, and group identity and esteem. And my argument would be the more oppressed and disadvantaged the group is, the more they need bonding social capital. Okay, if you think of Jewish people after the Second World War, many of them returned to many of their former cultural practices because they needed to bond together to withstand the assault that had just been made on them. or if you think of people who are acquiring consciousness as African Americans, they will use a food growing or a eating experience to cherish. And I think one of the speakers in this series talked about the African culinary experience and the importance of it. It's really a form of bonding, social capital. And certainly in Canada, in the Aboriginal communities, there's a big movement to use food as a way of gaining more respect for their food heritage. So it's not a thing of the elite, it is the thing actually of the non-elite's need. So why we sometimes refer to community gardens as gentrification from below. And it fosters a sense of community and place. I belong here. And that is, as a matter of fact, the slogan of the City of Toronto, you belong here. The second form of social capital is called bridging. One helps me feel proud of the fact that I come from a certain background, which if you push it to extremes can be very unhealthy. But if it's balanced with the other kind, which is, I can get a hold of all sorts of people who can help me out because we're all in this together. I believe the person who taught me what it meant in life, many of you know, is Will Allen from Growing Power in Milwaukee. And he has deliberately used food as a mechanism to bridge communities. So he often will put his community gardens right at the intersection of a white and black community. So people who have known themselves in one way, usually a stereotypical way, will now see each other with their hands in the garden and become friends on a totally different kind of basis. And then that leads to all sorts of other advantages. And a business professor from Harvard, Rosabeth Moss Cantor, wrote a book called World Class. What is it that distinguishes the cities that have a stake in the future and those that don't? Those that are going to succeed have what she calls collaborative infrastructure. They know how rich people can get in touch with poor people, how people in charities can get in touch with foundations, how people who've been in university can get in touch with people who are dropping out of high school. Okay, and so the richer the society is in social capital, the more different kinds of people can meet. And there's a new article just posted this morning in the Entrepreneur magazine where Cantor's research is updated right till today, and again says, the cities of the future are going to be the cities where you can cross the normal barriers. In other words, do not live in a bubble, live across bubbles. The point about that is you are not only what you eat, but you are who you eat with. And so the point of a food movement that understands social capital is that they would try to bring different kinds of people together around food. And it fosters inclusion, intercultural relations, and diverse partnerships. And fifth is, by and large, the thinking about food is dominated by its connection either with agriculture, that is production of food, or with nutrition. And I think what we need to carve out is a separate space, which is food as a people-centered food policy. So some of you may know the Ivan Illich, who wrote a whole book called The Tools for Conviviality. Food is tools for conviviality. Like if you want to bring the family together, you're not going to say, come on over, have a glass of water, like you're going to have a meal, right? And it's also connected with what are called by the social determinants of health. And the point of it is that it emphasizes human needs. So if I'm thinking about why we want to have a gardening program, I'm not just thinking, well, because the carrots are going to be fresher and have more nutrients in them, because the nutrients are volatile, and the longer they are in transit, the less nutritious it is, although that's important. It's not because you're on low income, and otherwise you wouldn't be able to afford carrots. It's because there is something about the human that they need to get their hands in the dirt. They need to be directly involved, and they need that authentic experience. And the last term is community of food practice. And because the food movement has grown up in the era of neoliberalism, namely when government is basically moving out of the government business, it has largely relied on informal means of connection. I do think it needs to have a strong government and political side, but the reality is that the food movement has grown up outside of government. And the informal practices are create in every city, I believe, there is a local food movement that's different in Ann Arbor than from Toronto. And if somebody says, oh, you do that? Oh, you must be from Ann Arbor. That means you've got a community of food practice here that's affected by the fact you're in Michigan, that it's an area of Michigan that isn't flat, it's not Detroit, it's got a big campus, it's got a big health center. It's going to have a different kind of feel than any other place in the world. The last point, Leslie is pretty proud of her cat, Charlie, but I didn't want to put her down when I was introduced to him this afternoon. But my cat is one hell of a lot smarter. And so the reason why I took the trouble to teach the cat how to do Rubik's Cube is that it's very important when dealing with food issues that you understand you cannot solve the problem by only looking at one side. You can only solve the Rubik's Cube by looking at six sides. And that has been the problem of food policy, that no one has treated it like a Rubik's Cube. You try to say, well, this is a farmer's problem, or this is a poor person's problem, or this is a obesity problem. And the point about food is that you need to understand that it is in its nature multifunctional. It is not just got one purpose. And the common saying for that, I think, is the whole is bigger than the parts. And there's a woman, a business professor in Montreal, Eleanor Dubé, who's referred to food as a whole of government, whole of society issue. Okay, it's not something for one department. I don't care if it's the health department or the ag department. It is one for all the departments in a government. And it is not a problem of one group, like people on low income or whatever. It is a problem of everyone in society, or an opportunity for everyone in society. And the point about understanding is multifunctionalism, it's a term which was originally developed in France, which is why I have the picture below of this sort of stereotypical French thing of someone riding along on their bicycle with a loaf of bread in the back. And the fact is that France does a lot of things to protect its agricultural economy, and they're challenged by all the people from the World Trade Organization, not least the United States, saying, you can't protect your farmers like that. It's not fair because we can't compete against them. And the French answer is, well, you know what? Food is not just about a commodity that you're pricing. We're talking about the heritage of France. We're talking about centuries of geography and of regionalism. And the main dynamo of the French economy is tourism. The main reason why people come to France is to eat French food. So we can't be selling them American food. They came from America to France to eat French food. So our whole economy would collapse if we followed that view that food is only one thing. It's how to get food from the dirt to the mouth as cheaply as possible. You can only see food as a multifunctional thing. In France, for example, they have chefs who come to school on Friday, the top chef of the town, to teach people how to appreciate food. They will have a whole class on tasting orange juice. And so for them, it is a whole of society, whole of government issue. And when you think about food, in other words, you don't just think about the commodity, that is, how much money do I get by selling this food, or how full does my stomach get from this much effort in my garden, but you think of general public services, like what's the environmental benefit, what's the general social benefit, what's the general health benefit. And finally, and I'll get into this in more detail, that food is not seen as an end in itself only, but as a lever to achieve other goals. So those are the seven things that I think you'll find helpful to think about. And now you got yourself a little question. Which of the following is an example of actionism? And you can choose between farmers markets, urban agriculture, craft beer, my personal favorite, this class, or all of the above. And I'm going to give you, shall we say, 10 seconds to give it an answer. Whoa! Everyone is right. But most right at the end, yeah. Okay, thank you. And because we're finishing off this section, so the question is for you to have just a personal evaluation. It'd be interesting. We can all know something about each other. What's your greatest strength? Are you an actionist, a solutionary, or a deliverologist? We'll give you again 10 or 15 seconds. I think our time is up. Wow, we got a lot of actionists and solutionaries. We should have put, I'm a negative energyist or something to give you a real choice. Thank you very much. So I didn't learn this actually until I'd retired, but just as I was about to retire, I went on a bus trip of all the food projects that we had established in low-income neighborhoods across the city of Toronto. And it happened that the person who was sitting beside me, named Elise Parker, was in charge of Toronto programs to pick up litter, to make sure that the city is clean. Sometimes Toronto, by the way, has been referred to as New York run by the Dutch. And there's like a real obsession with neatness. And so actually they have a person who's head of a department in charge of litter and not doing it, but collecting it. So, and as we went through the different projects, some of them had community gardens, some of them had community kitchens, some of them had farmers markets, and I'll show you some of the kinds of projects that they had. She came to see this, that the more people saw land as theirs, the more they cared for it and the more they made sure it didn't have litter, and the less they considered the land was theirs, the less they cared for it and the less they cared if it got littered. And so she became the chief champion in the city of community farmers markets, community kitchens, as a way to prevent litter. Okay, but that's what introduced me to the idea that food does not only do what we think it's going to do, fill your tummy, give you nutrients, help you meet the people around the table. It can do another thing entirely, which you have to really stretch your mind to see what its possibility is. And we need to think about food, especially at the government level or at the university level. What is it, a lever that allows us to achieve?
And that was Wayne Roberts speaking at the University of Michigan to their Sustainable Food Systems Initiative event, Food Literacy for All. That was on April 4th, 2017. We played that today because Wayne Roberts recently passed away on January 20th. He was a Canadian activist, food policy analyst, and author of books like Real Food for a Change and The No-Nonsense Guide to World Food, which was published in 2008. Wayne Roberts was, I think, a friend of mine. I like to think of him as a friend, but I was one of his students in a course at York University in the Environmental Studies Master's Degree Program back in the early 2000s. And I heard just recently that he had passed away. So today we dedicated these talks from Wayne Roberts in memory and tribute to him. So I hope you enjoyed that. Thanks for listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Ryan Young, and you can always email me, email the show at equilibrium@ckut.ca. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/equilibriumckutmontreal. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan V. Young, and I'm also on Instagram at Ryan Young Naturalist. That's all the time we have left. We're going to leave you with some music. Here is Katie Moore, who is a local Montreal artist, and this is the tune When You Disappear from her album Montebello from 2011. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures.